ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bruce Ferber.
Thank you all for coming out. I didn't mean to sit down. I just wanted to put my stuff down. It is great to see you here at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Saturday to support a book. That's awesome. I really want to thank Dynasty Typewriter, Vanessa Ragland, and Jamie Flam for letting us do this thing here. They are an incredible artistic directing team. Within a year, they've built this place up into the hottest alt comedy venue in town. So it's a great place, beautiful theater, and thank you guys for coming. Thank you to Tyson Cornell and Rare Bird Books for publishing the book. Our next contributor appears in the chapter entitled The Icon, which features those lucky enough to get their starts working with Hollywood legends or legends in the making. Her essay resonates because it captures the moment where a young person falls in love with filmmaking and identifies it as the path she must pursue. Please welcome that young person who went on to spend 23 years as a top Hollywood agent, rising to become head of the literary department at both the Gersh Agency and Innovative Artists. Please give it up for Nancy Nigrosh.
The sound on? Yes? Okay, good. Okay. While still a student at NYU Film School, I landed my first job in the film business as a New York location script supervisor. Little did I suspect that the film would go on to win the Palme d'Or at Cannes and get selected years later for the Library of Congress, or that the experience would ultimately take me to Hollywood, where, unlikely as it seemed at the time, I'd find my calling as a literary agent. As a graduate of Girls Latin School in Boston, I'd gotten an education based on a curriculum that had hardly changed since 1635. I believe New York University was another ivory tower and aimed to study linguistic anthropology. My not so modest ambition was to unlock the universal language key. "Don't waste your time," said one of my Manhattan-raised roommates. "The universal language is music, or body language, or film." So I ditched anthropology and transferred to NYU's School of the Arts Film Department. The department turned out to be on the eighth floor of a nondescript structure simply known as the East Building. Film students ran the gamut from 1970s ultra-hip to nondescript and a few vets who still wore army jackets. But all of them were obsessed with the past, present, and future of world cinema. My newbie cohort soon learned about a popular directing instructor. I remembered seeing his name on the class schedule and wondered how to pronounce it. Then I heard Marty had left teaching, yet somehow he still cast a presence on the eighth floor. His name was still being mentioned in the hallways or in class about the fact that he'd moved to Los Angeles. Though we'd never met Marty, we were all following his effort to become established. They divided us into crews, and we learned by working on each other's projects, rotating jobs. It was my turn to edit. One night, while working on a documentary about tenants' rights on the Lower East Side, I noticed it was 10 p.m. and I'd been working for 11 hours straight. "Who wants to work in a movie? I need two camera assistants, two gaffers, and a script girl," announced a voice I recognized as Mitchell Block, our TA. Mitchell Block eventually went on to become an award-winning documentary filmmaker. "There's coffee in it on me," Mitchell shouted over the din of our old-time moviolas, the same machines used to edit movies by Hollywood studios since the Golden Age. Four guys plus me, the only girl around, responded. We threw on our coats and shuffled past the school's funky purple walls, yawning and stretching. We piled into a station wagon parked in a red zone. "Is this your car?" I asked. "No, it belongs to the bank. It's a lease car." "What's a lease car?" I wondered. We pulled up in front of the Gramercy Park Hotel, a seedy place in those days. As the creaky and dark elevator cage took us upstairs, it occurred to me that maybe I'd made a mistake. Even after we arrived at the fairly well-lit hallway, the place was seriously run down and reeked of desperation. A door opened up and light spilled out like the sun had just come up. Our little flock poured into the room where several guys were pacing around as far as the phone cords would take them. They barely noticed us. Things settled down, though, when a compact dynamo with shoulder-length black hair entered the scene, instantly becoming the center of attention. "Mitchell, these the kids?" "Yeah, Marty," said Mitchell, who pointed out two camera assistants, two gaffers, and me, the script girl. Marty stopped in his tracks. "This girl? I mean, look at her. Look at me. Look at her." Just as he directed, the entire room stopped to take in my height. Marty threw up his hands, shaking his head. Then he left the room. I felt my feet move to follow him to another part of the suite where someone was still on the phone to the coast. Then it occurred to me, all these people were from California, a place I'd never been. Marty was at a nearby desk. I sat down and told him, "I don't have to be tall." He grinned and said, "That's good." Marty showed me his sketches for the film. He explained how he needed me to record the continuity of character and action notes he'd be giving me on the set, and that he'd be referring to them in the weeks and months ahead in the editing room in California. I worried generally about my illegible handwriting and hesitated. Maybe he was right. Maybe I was the wrong girl. He studied my expression. I could see he was getting impatient. "So, you think you can do this?" "Yes, I can," I nodded, even though I wasn't at all sure that I could. Then we both stood up. "Okay," he said, as if inspiration had just struck. He threw his shoulders forward as if to model a dance move or do a James Cagney imitation. I followed his lead and gently hunched in his direction, which you all saw up there in the picture, notching down my height. "Yeah," he beamed, "that's good." Marty's plan was to film on the streets of Manhattan's Little Italy where he grew up. That first night of shooting, I held my script close. I'd read it the night before and was impressed with how tight the cultural noose was around Charlie, played by Harvey Keitel. And I realized how lucky I was to have made that break from my own past by moving to New York and going to film school. Maybe I'd even move to Los Angeles someday. This overwhelming thought was interrupted by Mitchell, who handed me a stopwatch so I could time rehearsals and actual takes. "Put it around your neck, always wear it, never take it off." Then Mitchell checked in on the rest of the students assisting the camera crew. Our production toys could hardly compare to the contents and scale of the dozens of steel boxes the California crew was unloading and inspecting. Almost all the students in my classes were young men who believed they were destined to direct or shoot or produce films. The students on our set were happy to be doing what they already knew they loved. They were prepared for their jobs, far better than I was for mine, and the director had already expressed his doubts. My stomach was in flip-flops. "Listen up, everybody pay attention," announced the assistant director affably and confidently. Then he turned a bit dark and added, "You need to work fast, we're a non-union production. We have to stay one step ahead of the local Teamsters. Got it?" There were nods all around except for me because I wasn't sure what non-union meant. Then I heard that the local cops who grew up with Marty were watching out for our nascent film director and his crew. Marty's ties to the neighborhood were its own kind of union, and you could tell that everyone was very proud of him. He'd already directed two low-budget features, but this one was a serious look at the neighborhood itself. I tried to keep a lid on my insecurities, but I definitely couldn't hide anything from Marty. Though he moved at a physical and verbal pace I'd never seen before, at the same time he could read people around him. I discovered that getting his attention could be fun. He had encyclopedic knowledge of classic films. "You know that scene at the end of The Searchers?" he asked. I nodded confidently to this question. Like every kid on the eighth floor, I was deadly serious about the art and craft of filmmaking. Of course I knew that scene. They finally find Natalie Wood, but then she runs away from the murderous hatred in her Uncle Ethan's eyes that made him look more barbaric than the Indians who'd kidnapped her. Then Marty described the cinematic strategy John Ford had used, shot by shot, to create the immortal impact of The Searchers. I was having this conversation on a working film set and not in one of my classrooms. Marty was directing me, very generously, to be at ease. The first scenes were documentary-style shots of the San Gennaro Festival. Marty needed the actors on real New York streets, since most of the film had already been shot in California. We focused on getting the footage Marty wanted as if our lives depended on it. We worked 18-hour days. Sleep was something the rest of the world did. One night, Marty's mom, Catherine, acted in a scene while other Scorsese family friends, Joe Cupcake, Frankie Bananas, and Larry the Box, gave additional support to the crew or acted as extras. A restaurant in Marty's old neighborhood opens its doors at 3 a.m. and treated us to the meal of our lives. For years afterward, Joe Cupcake sent me Christmas cards. Standing for hours, hunched next to Marty, I was finally keeping pace with the speed of his notes. During breaks, I was neatening and polishing them as fast as I could. Only once did I totally fuck up. In one scene, Johnny Boy, played by Bobby De Niro, was holding a gun. In the middle of shooting, he'd switched hands. "The gun needs to be in your other hand," I shouted. De Niro stepped out of the scene and walked up to me. "Please don't do that," he said in a soft voice that made you feel like you had his complete attention and maybe that wasn't a good thing. Then he walked back into the scene as though nothing had happened. Afterwards, he couldn't have been nicer. And after such dizzying intensity in the real film world, it was hard to imagine going back to school. The last scene took place in an old cemetery. The camera crew surprised me with flowers because it happened to be my birthday. Finally, I got to stretch out on the cold ground and lean against a thin granite tombstone. Clutching my script, now fat with notes to Marty, I held tight to the flowers and the stopwatch around my neck. Then I looked up at the moon and thought, so this is the film business. Wonder if anyone will ever see this little movie.